It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. In just a few minutes, Senator Ron Johnson joins the show. He's been in the news for his comments on U.S. efforts against ISIS and on Ebola policy. We'll hear what he has to say.
First, we continue our new series on the issues in the race for governor. Governor Scott Walker and his challenger Mary Burke disagree on a lot of issues, including school funding. As Kristen Durst reports, the issue is especially important in Wisconsin's rural districts.
There are 340 students enrolled in the school district of Potosi, a community in far southwestern Wisconsin near the Mississippi River. The town has a successful and growing brewery, but Superintendent Ron Sari says business-wise, there's not much else.
We really have no major industries. We're a bedroom community for the most part. A lot of the people who work travel and commute to Dubuque or else Platteville, some possibly to Lancaster.
Schools in small rural towns across Wisconsin are struggling. Enrollment is declining, poverty is rising, and transportation costs are considerable. Jerry Feeney is the executive director of the Wisconsin Rural Schools Alliance.
Really, for the last 20 years since the revenue limits went into effect, rural schools have been faced with significant challenges in being able to maintain the programs and offerings that they're providing for their students.
The current school funding formula places a lot of emphasis on enrollment and property values. So when rural districts lose students, they lose money. Feeney says often the only good choice they have is to appeal directly to local taxpayers.
Over the past 10 years, there have been nearly 1,000 referenda to exceed the revenue limit. And of those, 80% are rural school districts.
Lawmakers so far have avoided the issue. That's because it would likely require investing a lot more money or taking money from wealthier districts. And that's politically unpopular. Governor Scott Walker says both sides are to blame for not addressing the problem.
That's an issue that for years Democrat and Republican alike people have talked about but haven't been able to take on the old school aid formula.
Walker's campaign is largely focused on expanding state funding for private voucher schools, and he's not saying how much money he'd be willing to provide for public education. However, Walker says his next budget, if elected, would include more focused aid for rural schools, as recommended by a legislative task force convened last year.
We're going to build off of that and incorporate it in our budget to try and give more attention not only for transportation costs, but for distance learning costs and other things that offset some of the challenges that rural schools have across the state.
His challenger, Democrat Mary Burke, says she wants to remake Wisconsin's school funding formula to help rural schools if the budget allows. She's also not saying how much money she would give public schools, only saying that she would prioritize funding for K-12 public education.
What I want to do as we, certainly hopefully as we grow the economy and we get in better shape, that we're able to put more money into K-12 education, which if you're doing it, then that's the best time to change the funding formula because you're not taking from one district and putting it in another district.
Back in Potosi, Superintendent Sari says their 1950s school building is aging and needs attention. He says they've been surveying members of the community, asking them questions like, do you want our school to continue to exist? He says some people are worried.
When a school shuts down in a town like Potosi, they say that the town kind of goes dead. The school is seen as the heart of the community.
Sari says his district is trying to provide the best education they can with the resources available. But he says as state aid continues to decrease, that is becoming more and more difficult. Kristen Durst, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Two major international stories are hitting home here in the U.S. this week, with ongoing efforts against ISIS in the Middle East and growing concern over the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and cases of the transmission of the disease to healthcare workers in Texas.
Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has been in the news talking about both those issues, and he joins us now. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the show.
Hello, Veronica. Hello, Rob. How are you guys doing?
Good, thank you. Well, you've been critical of the Obama administration's approach to combating ISIS in the past, but you have spoken favorably about the current plan using airstrikes to support the Iraqi army, Kurdish fighters, and moderate Syrian rebels. Do you think that strategy will work to degrade and destroy ISIS?
No, the evidence is that it's not working. I supported it, and I agree with the goal that President Obama stated, which is to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. I think we need to ultimately destroy Islamic terrorists. But President Obama made a blunder when he announced the goal in taking off the very actions that are probably going to be necessary to achieve that goal. And the evidence I use, I'm not a military expert, but just take a look at history. In 2007, in order to defeat 6,000 to 8,000 members of al-Qaeda in Iraq, we had 100,000 Sunnis working with over 100,000 Iraqi security forces. America had 160,000 Americans in Iraq. About 35,000 to 40,000 of those military members were engaged in direct combat in the clear and hold strategy to defeat 6,000 to 8,000 members of al-Qaeda in Iraq. Now, we have over 30,000 members of ISIS that are better equipped, better trained, better resourced. They're a far greater threat, and we've got 1,500 apparently advisors, and the coalition is not growing because America's not providing the kind of leadership, and the bombing campaign isn't even containing ISIS, much less beginning the degradation process, and we are a long ways from defeating or destroying ISIS. So, unfortunately, that strategy is not working.
Now, you've said on this show, in fact, in the past, that you'd be open to sending American ground troops to Iraq to fight ISIS. And based on where we are now, do you think that's necessary, considering you've just said that the airstrikes don't seem to be getting the job done?
I think it is necessary because what are we going to do, continue to let ISIS roll up territory, take over more cities, massacre more people? I believe it was another blunder on President Obama's part not to leave a stabilizing force of the 20,000 to 24,000 military personnel is what the generals recommended at the time to leave a stabilizing force behind Iraq. Had we done that, we wouldn't be faced with this the current disaster that's on our hands. So if you agree with President Obama's stated objective, if you believe, and I do believe, that ISIS represents a clear and present danger to our country, we don't have a choice as to whether or not we're going to be at war with Islamic terror. They made that choice for us back as early as 1993 when they first started to attempt to bring down the Twin Towers. Our only choice, our only decision is how are we going to fight that war? Are we going to be on the defense? Are we going to fight it here on the streets of America? Or are we going to go on offense? And how robust is that offense going to be? Are we going to treat it like a hornet's nest we take out? Or are we just going to poke that hornet's nest with a stick for a few years and just allow the threat to hang over our heads?
Now, what you're describing has all the earmarks of being a long haul. Do you think the American people support the idea of sending ground troops back to Iraq so soon after the last intervention?
Are we going to wait and have terrorists attack us here in America? This is going to be a long-term struggle. Islamic terrorists have been at war with the West and America for more than 20 years. We buried our head in the sand in the 90s, and the result was thousands of Americans were slaughtered in 9/11, when they did finally bring down the Twin Towers. So, again, nobody relishes war. I wish we didn't have to worry about Islamic terrorists, but we do, and we ignore that threat at our own peril.
I want to ask you about a study that was out this week. In fact, it was an internal report by the CIA, which says that arming rebels rarely works. We're still using that technique with Syria right now, with Syrian rebels. Should the U.S. stop using that tactic?
Well, I don't believe it will work. I mean, the most we're able to train is maybe 5,000 Syrian moderates, and that won't occur for a year. What will 5,000 Syrian moderates be able to do against 30,000 members of ISIS? And by the way, those numbers are growing because as ISIS continues to have success, as we continue not to be able to contain them, they're successfully recruiting out the internet, and success breeds success from that standpoint. So, they're just gaining strength. They're not being degraded. So, arming rebels simply is not going to be sufficient to achieve the goal that President Obama set, and the goal that I agree with is we got to defeat these guys. You cannot negotiate with people that behead other human beings, that crucify people, that engage in mass executions, and what they do to women. I don't even want to describe it on the radio. It is horrific. It is barbaric. You can't negotiate with those people. You have to defeat them.
I want to get a caller in on this. We're going to take one from Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hello. We've already spent, like, by the time we get it paid off, maybe $1 trillion or more trying to, turn Iraq into a democratic society. And I don't think that worked very well. And I was just wondering how much the senator often speaks of fiscal responsibility, how much money and how many lives, American lives, is he willing to commit to this endless battle? And I think the comment about fighting Islamic terrorists on the streets of America is the biggest fear-mongering I think I've ever heard. I think that's absurd. To think that's going to happen.
All right. Thank you for that call, Willem. Do you see it in that frame, Senator Johnson, between fiscal responsibility and national security?
No, I think you can be penny-wise and pound-foolish if we just sit and bury our heads in the sand. The fact of the matter is, whether you agree whether we should have ever gone into Iraq, we had won the war. President Obama lost the peace. We had a largely stable Iraq. Now, it was a very fragile coalition. Shia did not trust Sunni. Sunni did not trust Shia. And so the glue that would hold that coalition, that would bind that coalition, keep it together, really was an American military presence. But President Obama decided to bug out. He did not leave the stabilizing force. He didn't learn the lessons of history like we didn't leave a stabilizing force behind like we did in Germany and Japan and South Korea. Look at how successful those nations turned out, because America, as President Obama himself has now admitted, is the indispensable nation. And when we bug out, when we don't provide the kind of leadership that the world requires, vacuums and voids of leadership occur, and very bad things fill those voids. And so we did sacrifice greatly, and we have spent close to $1 trillion, and 4,500 brave Americans, 32,000 were injured in that war. President Obama wasted that sacrifice. He frittered it away, and it's a real tragedy. It's a real shame, but now we have a worse situation, but it's a situation we can't ignore.
Now, you have expressed satisfaction with the partnership of five Arab nations joining the United States effort to stop ISIS. So do you feel good at least about the coalition building that may be going on?
Listen, I was supportive when President Obama finally decided to act and engage in some airstrikes. But that was a number of weeks ago, and the facts on the ground, the reality of the situation is it didn't work. It was a good sign that Arab nations were willing to publicly support the coalition efforts. But and this is a real problem for President Obama. I don't envy him his task. The real conundrum is, if America leads too much, the Arab states will once again sit back and go, okay, let's let America do all the work. Let's let them do the heavy lifting. But if we don't lead enough, and that's what's happening right now, we're not providing the type of leadership. We've taken certain actions off the ground, so our coalition partners also are not engaging and are not committing the way they need to be committed. So this is not easy, but it's going to require American leadership, and we really are not providing the leadership to the extent that we will need to in order to assemble the coalition. And the template that I've certainly spoke to coalition partners when I was in New York during the UN General Assembly is I used the first Iraq war. When America provided two-thirds of the troops, a little under 500,000 Americans served in that effort. But our coalition partners provided close to 250,000. That war effort cost $61 billion. America paid for $9 billion, about 15%. Arab states actually provided about 50% of the funding for the first Gulf War. That was the example. That was the template. That is what we should be trying to achieve in this coalition.
We're talking right now with Ron Johnson, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, getting his thoughts on U.S. efforts in Iraq and Syria and the American reaction to Ebola. We'll be talking about that coming up.
Join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Should the U.S. have acted sooner to support moderate rebels in Syria? Should we continue the campaign of airstrikes against ISIS? And turning to Ebola, should we have stronger travel restrictions for countries facing major Ebola outbreaks? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We continue our conversation now with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson talking about U.S. efforts against ISIS in Iraq and Syria, as well as reactions to the ongoing news about Ebola in the United States.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for the senator and your comments. Do you support the use of airstrikes against ISIS? Should ground troops be on or off the table? And when it comes to Ebola, would you support travel restrictions from affected countries? What do you think of the U.S. response? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Senator Johnson, turning to Ebola now. Now, you've called for travel restrictions from West African countries affected by the disease. What kind of restrictions are you hoping for?
Well, certainly we need to allow aid workers and health workers to, you know, travel back and forth from West Africa so that we can try and contain the disease there. I'm fully supportive of President Obama using our military construction workers to build the isolation units and the medical facilities to try and contain it in West Africa. That's our first line of defense. And so obviously those individuals have to travel back and forth. Now, we probably ought to take precautions in terms of isolation, making sure that that there are isolation and, if necessary, quarantines for the incubation period so that people that have been in West Africa aren't free to roam around and potentially infect people here in America and let that get out of control. And I really see no reason for citizens of those countries to freely travel between our nations. And once again, if they want to come to America, they should be isolated for 21 days before they travel here. So I think that's a reasonable precaution. I'd rather be safe than sorry.
Now, the head of the CDC just today, Thomas Frieden, has said that it's better to know the travelers that are coming into your country rather than having them try to slip through into the country undetected, that ultimately is safer when it comes to keeping Ebola out of America. What do you say to that?
I just don't think it makes any sense. And he's also saying that a travel ban would risk a greater exposure, greater spread of the disease. That makes no sense. It doesn't make sense to many Americans. Other African nations have instituted a strict travel ban, and they are Ebola-free. We have a case of Ebola. Now, we have a couple cases of Ebola. And unfortunately, the CDC simply has not been credible. It just doesn't make sense what they're saying, and their bland assurances are proving false, and so they've really lost the confidence of the American public, and that's a real shame. We really need a strong CDC and National Institute of Health to protect our public health, and right now Americans are losing confidence in those bland assurances.
The CDC has been sharply criticized in recent weeks. Critics of yours have said that you were on board with cutting funding to the CDC through federal budget cuts. How do you respond to that?
Well, first of all, it's simply not true, and what the CDC needs to do is prioritize spending. You know, I'm starting to see reports of different agencies within the CDC where they spend hundreds of millions of dollars more on just nonsense grants, funding nonsense research, and they only spend somewhere between $13 and $35 million on looking for cures and vaccines for Ebola. So I think it's not a matter of not enough funding, it's a matter of prioritization of spending within the CDC. That's just a problem with government in general.
Let's take a call now. David is with us in Burlington. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you very much for having the show. Thanks, Senator Johnson. Appreciate that. One comment and one question. The comment is that we're 2 months too late in having restrictions from people traveling from countries with Ebola that should have been in place a long time ago, obviously. Now, the other one is let's look 6 months down the road. And let's say we have 5,000 cases of Ebola in America. What is going to be put in place to have containment and restrictions here in the United States if that were to occur?
Okay, thank you, David. Senator Johnson?
Well, first of all, let's hope it doesn't get that far out of control. And I really do believe the CDC is learning some lessons. But, I just want listeners to just imagine yourself. Let's say you have the funds and to travel, and you're in West Africa, and you tragically come in contact with an Ebola patient, what is the first thing you're going to do? I mean, I'm going to try and hop a flight and get to America where I could potentially be treated in a hospital that might save my life. And so that basic human tendency is exactly what we have to defend ourselves against, and what this administration is doing is they're taking people's temperature, which, by the way, if you're in that position, you're going to travel well before the 21-day incubation period before you're going to show symptoms, and you cannot rely on people to honestly answer questions that would really prevent them from getting on that flight. So you have to understand basic human nature. You got to recognize that reality, and you have to put the procedures and protocols in place to defend America, and that really is travel restrictions, some selective travel bans. You got to get serious about this, and this administration just is not taking the decisive action to protect America.
Now, Congressman Reed Ribble today issued a press release calling for an emergency session of Congress to deal with Ebola. Briefly, getting close to our time together here, but would you support that idea?
Absolutely. I actually spoke with Chairman Carper, who's the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, which I serve on, and I talked to him last night, or was it two nights ago, asking him to hold a hearing. And again, not as a show trial, but to really be able to ask administration officials, officials of the CDC and the NIH, you know, the appropriate questions, the questions that Americans want to know. I mean, it still boggles my mind that the government has not told us exactly how those nurses became infected. What was the breach in protocol? What was the protective wear? You know, what protective measures did they take? You know, it is unbelievable to me that they weren't in full, you know, protective gear, that there was any areas of their bodies that were exposed. I mean, we've all seen Ebola in Africa. We've seen the health workers fully clothed.
And I'm sorry, we have to leave it there. We're out of time. Senator Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Have a great day.
That was Senator Johnson, U.S. Senator from Wisconsin. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farah. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, he lost the war, but is celebrated as a clever strategist. We'll hear the story of Chief Blackhawk coming up in Curious Wisconsin.
First, with yesterday's release of the annual fiscal report from Wisconsin's Department of Administration, we got the clearest picture yet of the health of the state's finances leading up to the gubernatorial elections, but that picture is still a bit murky.
The budget ended the last fiscal year with a $517 million surplus, which is over $200 million less than projected when the legislature passed the budget last year, but it's unclear how these numbers will affect the state's projected budget shortfall. And with some numbers still being crunched, it's also uncertain whether or not the next legislature will have to take emergency action.
Joining us now with some perspective on the budget situation is Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So now that we are in the lead up to the election, the stakes on reports like this, they get raised a little bit. So with that in mind, what's in this report that's most important for voters to understand?
Well, I think the first thing to say is it's a snapshot of a year that ended at the end of June. So, I mean, the numbers are already a little bit on the old side. And it's sort of a glass half empty, glass half full story in that we had a $759 million surplus the year before. And now we've pulled it down to $517 million. And the reason is we're spending more than we're bringing in the biennium, but the budget is balanced simply because we had a large enough surplus. The good news, in a sense, is that we, with the revenues dropping a little bit, we were probably on track for the surplus to have dropped to something over $440 million, and by screwing down the spending a little bit, they were able to raise that number to $517 million. So, you know, there's talking points for everyone.
Right. Well, speaking of glass half empty, glass half full, you know, we see the word surplus, and we think, well, that's good, but it's significantly smaller than what was projected. I don't know. How do you weigh those two
well,
things?
Well, no, I mean, it is and it isn't. Yes, we had a revenue surprise this spring that pulled it down by 281. We've also had a spending, retrenchment that pulled it up by 70 to 80 million. But underlying this all, I think it's important to remember that we are in the middle of several phased tax cuts, one going back as far as 2011. So you would expect these, you know, overall budget numbers, whether it's surpluses or tax collections or whatever, to be coming down a little bit, and that is indeed reflected in this past year and what will be, you know, this year, we're spending more than we're bringing in.
Well, I guess one question that seems to be unanswered at the moment is, are these permanent fixes when we look at any kind of surplus, or is this sort of just postponing, you know, the inevitable, having to pay some bills down the road and
well,
pay for some other stuff?
Yeah, I raised that with the Wisconsin State Journal yesterday. You know, it's good news that they were able to save a little bit more money than they thought and boost the reserve by $70-80 million. But, you know, there's a couple ways you can do that. One is you can permanently get rid of a program. Another is you can decide you're not going to hire people in May or June. You'll simply hire them in July. So there's a lot of different ways to move these numbers up and down when there's a fixed time period, June 30, that cuts off the fiscal year. And that's nothing new for politicians of either party. There have been, over the last 10 to 15 years, lots of examples of moving things backwards or forwards across a fiscal year.
So when do we get more solid answers to that question?
Well, I mean, we have solid answers in the annual fiscal report through June of last year. I mean, the books closed on a cash basis. You know, we have $517 million to the good. What we don't know is whether the slowdown in tax collections earlier in the year will continue, or whether the collections will resume acceleration. This has been a very hard year to read. I mean, we had a first quarter where the nation actually contracted. And then we had a second quarter where we grew fairly nicely. And it's sort of been like that for the last few years. You'll have good times, you'll have bad times. So it becomes very hard to say with any certainty what the tax collections are going to end up at, and therefore, you know, whether there's going to be a surplus or a deficit. I mean, right now it looks like, all of the things being equal, we're on track for, perhaps a small negative number. Again, it depends on what happens with tax collections.
Well, we're also hearing a lot about a $1.8 billion structural deficit
projected for 2015.
I'll
be really blunt. I wish we would stop having that discussion, because legislators of both parties have long misused the way that report was meant to be used, and it isn't a deficit, because there's no assumptions being made about spending for the next 2 years or revenue for the next 2 years. It does suggest what I already said earlier, that in the current 2 years, we are spending more than we're bringing in revenue. But to then call it a deficit and suggest that that's where we're going to be at the end of 2017 is a real rhetorical reach, I think, because typically when you inherit a problem with a budget, you make cuts or you increase taxes when that new budget period begins, and it pretty much changes the nature of the discussion. I mean, that's what Governor Doyle had to do when he came in. That's what Governor Walker had to do when he came in. It is a structural imbalance. It does say we're spending more than we're bringing in, but the way the legislators are talking about this, the way the media is talking about it, they're attaching the word deficit to it, which suggests somehow we're already going to have a deficit in 2 years, and
we get that these numbers are elastic. That's part of what you're saying.
Well,
here,
I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying they're being mislabeled.
But the people want to know, right? Or do we need to start thinking about a budget repair bill?
That will depend on tax collections in the next few months. Yes, as things stand now, we could have a slight deficit to, somewhere between 50, 300 million. I'm literally pulling numbers out of the air. And depending on the size of that, we may need a budget repair bill. Or, as we get toward the end of the calendar year, the governor may say, well, the problem isn't so bad that we can't fine-tune it with stopping hiring or travel or whatever. That's pretty much what they did with the numbers that just came in. They found a way to squeeze $70 to $80 million out of spending.
Now, in your recent blog post on your website, you laid out two actions that you think the next governor could take to help end Wisconsin's sort of roller coaster budget effect to even the ups and downs, make it more stable. What would you suggest?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is really more what we should be talking about, because we know that there has been in state law for over a decade language that says we're supposed to have a budget reserve equal to 2% of spending, and no governor or legislator of either party has allowed that law to become effective. They simply keep delaying it. So in many ways, this discussion about do we have a deficit, don't we have a deficit, is sort of silly, because we bring it on ourselves by not implementing that law that has been on the books since, you know, the early part of the 2000s. To make matters worse, there is another law on the books that says you cannot have a structural imbalance between revenues and expenditures in the second year of the biennium. And as with the other law, legislators and governors simply say, well, it doesn't apply to this budget. Those two items alone, if we had been living with them for the last 10 to 15 years, we wouldn't be having these constant conversations about deficits, because we would have larger balances and we would have to fix things when they started to get out of whack. And I won't even mention the rainy day fund law that's been around since 1986 that we've never fully used, while other states have been setting aside 5 or 10% of their spending in reserve, we sort of limp along, 1%, 1.5%. So we have the tools on the books. Neither party, neither branch has chosen to use them.
Well, considering that doesn't seem terribly likely to happen, at least in the next year or so, what is your takeaway for these numbers? A little something for everyone here, it sounds like.
Well, yeah, I mean, we do have at the moment a surplus. We are spending more than we're bringing in. We're going to pretty much dissipate that surplus in the next year. We know that for sure. Whether the number ends up slightly positive, mildly negative, or a little more negative really depends on the economy. And like I said, the economy has been stopping and starting for a while.
Anything you'll be watching for in the coming weeks and months to give you a clearer picture, or is this as clear as it gets?
Well, I'll tell you what I would really like to see. I would really like to see the next governor live by state law and propose a budget that includes a 2% reserve, that does not spend more than it brings in revenue in either year of the next budget, and that might actually put money in the rainy day fund before the state law forces them to put it in, which is what's been going on. Again, we have the tools. Are they willing to use them?
Well, Todd, thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking to Todd Barry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. He joined us to help make sense of the state's budget situation heading into the election. The race for governor has tightened again, with Republican Governor Scott Walker and Democratic challenger Mary Burke tied at 47% among likely voters in a poll released Wednesday, yesterday, by Marquette University Law School. Mary Burke seems to have eliminated Governor Walker's 5-point lead among likely voters in the Marquette poll 2 weeks ago.
And now we want to hear from you, a little informal survey. Have you changed your mind in this election, or are you one of the elusive undecided voters who hasn't decided yet? What are you watching for in the 3 weeks leading up to the election? Or have you already done an early vote? You're done watching and just going to wait for the results in November. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org.
This race is an incredibly close one. It's gaining national attention, and it seems to depend in some scenarios, as we hear, upon turnout. Midterms have generally a lower turnout, seems to generally favor Republicans, as the common wisdom goes. What about you? Are you going to make the effort to turn out to the polls for this race? How much does this race matter to you? 800-642-1234 is our number.
And are you watching closely as the new polls come in, as new news stories develop on this, as voter ID comes, goes, comes back, and then goes away again? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. By the way, join us tonight at 7 on Wisconsin Public Radio for the Here and Now Wisconsin Vote Candidate Special. This interview program, anchored by WPR's Glenn Moberg and WPT's Frederica Freiberg, features in-depth information from the front-running candidates in the governor's race. That's the Here and Now Wisconsin Vote Candidate Special tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And we'll go to our first caller. And in the meantime, if you're an undecided voter, what are you waiting for? Do you exist? Call us at 800-642-1234. What is it going to take for you to make up your mind? We're going to go now to Tommy in Milwaukee. Hi, Tommy.
Hey.
Hi, what do you think?
I think it's very important to raise the minimum wage. I think it's very important to get the lower income wage people off the government dollar. And I think that's a big push forward for Wisconsin. People need to be independent. They need to be able to support their family. I don't care what kind of job or what kind of education you have. If you do the job hard, you're working every day, you deserve to make the buck. And you deserve to take care of your family.
And Tommy, is that your primary issue? Is that the main thing that's motivating you when you go to the polls in November?
That is, yes. That and, of course, the environment is another big factor. And the mining. I mean, I'm really worried about that. I'm really worried about regulations on it. And I hope the big buck isn't pushing, lack of research on it.
Gotcha. Tommy, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your call, and you can join us now. We've got an open line for you at 800-642-1234. As we watch this, these numbers from the Marquette poll sort of widen, come back together, contract again this week, it's an exciting race to watch. We're not sure which way the cookie is going to crumble, and we want to know what you're thinking as we move into these final stretches.
Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've got Terry on the line now in Weyerhaeuser. Terry, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think that I don't have a lot of complaints about Governor Wallace. I like some of the things he's done, but I don't like the way he did them. My second thing is I'd like to know what Mary Burke is going to do with the concealed carry law. If she's going to try to abolish that, then I wouldn't vote for her.
Okay.
That's my two concerns.
So concerns,
and who's going to save us the most money?
Concerns about each of them. Does that mean you're one of the undecided voters that the candidates are paying so much attention to?
At this point, I am.
What would you want to hear that would sway you one direction or another, Terry?
Well, if Mary Burke says she will continue the concealed carry, I probably will vote for her.
All right, Terry, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, how about you? Is there an issue that's going to sway you in this election, or are you unswayable at this juncture? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go next to Julie in Sun Prairie. Hi, Julie.
Hello. I'm going to vote for Mary Burke, and I don't mean any disrespect to her, but it's almost an anti-Scott Walker vote. He does not tell the truth. He looks us in the eyes and tells us one thing and turns around and does something else. I've lost complete trust for him. I voted Republican in my past. I voted Democrat in my past. But I am not going to vote for this person that's telling us one thing and doing something else. And one other thing that I'm doing, when I get these calls saying, oh, I'm from the America for Prosperity, who are you going to vote for? I tell them I'm voting for the Republicans because I want them to get a false sense of security because they have to go. Thank you.
So you're not so much voting for Mary Burke as against Governor Walker. Julie, thank you so much for calling us.
We go now to Bill with us in Middleton. Bill, hi.
Yeah, well, not really, but I like what the last guy said about liking some of the things Walker's done. I agree with him on the carry also, the carry law. But I didn't like the way that they were done necessarily, and I don't know if that was all his fault because there was a lot of pushback that I didn't like that ad very much either. But if Mary Burke were to decide unequivocally that she's not going to make any changes to Act 10, I would support her in a minute. But I have not heard her really pressed on that issue, and I'd like to hear that because otherwise I'll probably vote for Walker just to make sure that Act 10 is in place because I'm a taxpayer, and I think these people, sure, they don't earn maybe what they ought to really earn, but as far as the state's ability to pay, I think they got a pretty darn good deal.
All right, Bill, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective.
And we go next to Adam in Madison. Hi, Adam. Oh, we lost Adam. All right. I'm going to try Adam one more time. Adam, are you with us?
I am.
Adam, great. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I've generally been a Democrat. You know, I support women's rights. I support education. I support the environment. But I have concern with the Democratic Party, various states really pushing for significantly higher minimum wage. My concern with that is not people getting, you know, paid a fair salary or getting paid fairly in order to support their family. Obviously, I support that. The problem that I see is you're not raising professional industry wages to a point where I see a risk for our children or people wanting to go back for secondary education. And what does that do for world competition?
Gotcha, Adam. I'm sorry we're going to have to leave it there, but I appreciate you calling in to share your thoughts with us today.
And thanks for all of your calls, getting your opinions on the race for governor.